The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Look, unfortunately for America, the court isn't necessarily wrong that this is the way the framers wanted it to be.
Conservative columnist David French writes about the decision in a new piece for the New York Times entitled, "The Supreme Court Just Erased Part of the Constitution."
Not since Bush v. Gore have we seen a court that's had this many opportunities to interfere in the election going forward.
My larger reaction is disappointment. I do believe that states should be able under our Constitution to bar oath-breaking insurrectionists. So ultimately, it will be up to the American voters to save our democracy in November. Regardless of this decision, American democracy still remains very much under attack and at threat. And this upcoming election will be crucial for democracy survival in the United States.
Shoddy legal work all around by all the justices.
There are certain conservative justices that have been appointed by Trump that want to help him.
This is another example among many that are playing out right now of the Supreme Court playing a huge role in American elections. And it's not necessarily the case that that's a good thing for the Supreme Court. It's seen by many people as the court essentially interfering in some sense in the election.
They're just making it up. And all the justices were making it up.
Protection for the country against oath-breaking insurrectionists. Oath-breaking insurrectionists will an oath-breaking insurrectionist. So that an oath-breaking insurrectionist, they were doing a favor to oath-breaking insurrectionists. In particular, when Donald J. Trump. Yes, 100 years from now, that's still going to be an object lesson in how courts should not decide cases and in how a court, by a 5-4 decision, can fundamentally destroy the Constitution's deliberate protection against office holding by oath-breaking insurrectionists.
So ultimately, it will be up to the American voters to save our democracy in November.
Okay. So if the American voters don't vote the right way and save democracy, then what? Well, you see, this is a no-brainer decision. We talked about it at length on yesterday's show. Go back and see it at trumpetdaily.com or at the Rumble channel. But it's one of the easiest no-brainer decisions for the Supreme Court in history. As you can see from the 9-0 decision. But for their heads to explode, the regime media, for their heads to explode like this, it shows you just how desperate they are. It shows you that when the lawfare strategy begins to break down, I mean, the Colorado Secretary of State lady, she basically said the quiet part out loud. Yeah, if we can't destroy him by removing him from the ballot, I guess the voters will actually have to step in and decide if they're going to save democracy. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us on today's show. You can get to, as I mentioned, you can get to the live stream of this show every weekday morning at 11:05 a.m. in the Central Time Zone of the U.S. at trumpetdaily.com or at the Rumble channel, rumble.com/Trumpet Daily. So here they are. They told us many weeks ago, they told us several months ago that this case coming out of Colorado, it was unassailable. This was clear cut, open and shut, no problemo. It was going to go right on through. And then they lost 9-0 at the Supreme Court level. 9-0. How do you get the three ladies on the far left to agree on this? That a state, in this case Colorado, can't just decide who's going to be on a federal election for president of the United States. This is Jesse Waters from Fox News yesterday talking about these liars. They're lying. They lied when they said the case was unassailable, and now they're out there lying again. Even if you would have listened to the oral arguments a few weeks back, you would have known that there were the more astute commentators were saying, well, boy, it seems like this could be at least 8-1, maybe even 9-0. But the liars, they kept right on lying. And there's no humility. There's no admission that they got it wrong. There's no consideration of why the Supreme Court made the decision it did. They just keep on spewing the propaganda nonstop. Nothing will slow them down. This is Jesse Waters, clip 9.
So many people on television, and I would never do this, gave the country false hope. And these people went to law school. I proudly did not go to law school, but even I could read the 14th Amendment, and it was clear to even me, just a bachelor's degree from Trinity College, a safety school, that this was not going to go the way the Democrats thought it was going to go. Yet, these people, they call them judicial pundits at the networks and on cable, came out strongly saying that this case had a shot. And now the same people, we'll do this tonight at 8 o'clock, the same people are saying, yes, we always knew that it was going to be a unanimous decision. They're lying to you. Everyone's been lying to you from the Bragg case to Jack Smith to Fannie. They're all getting everyone's hopes up. And they're now all of a sudden having to grapple with the fact, this is a direct quote, we're going to have to win this at the ballot box. They're all admitting this was the strategy. They're admitting they have nothing except lawyers and judges. They just wanted to persuade a few judges, not the American people. Because if you look at the polls, the American people have not been persuaded.
They're all waking up to the fact that they're going to have to win this at the ballot box. That's Jesse pointing out what I just said. They're saying the quiet part out loud. They're saying this was the strategy all along. This was how we intended to beat Trump. We just needed to convince a few radical judges or maybe a few jury members and get him off the ballot or send him off to prison or fine him $500 million. And that'll take care of the problem. Listen again to this Colorado Secretary of State as she talks about how that they should have the right in Colorado to just remove him from the ballot. And now she's talking about the voters having to decide as if that's almost a bad thing. This is a clip 5.
My larger reaction is disappointment. I do believe that states should be able under our Constitution to bar oath-breaking insurrectionists. And ultimately, this decision leaves open the door for Congress to act to pass authorizing legislation. But we know that Congress is a nearly non-functioning body. So ultimately, it will be up to the American voters to save our democracy in November.
Hopefully, the state should be able to do it. Maybe it leaves the door open for Congress to do something. But, you know, as a last resort, maybe we'll just have to put it before the American people. Maybe we'll actually have to have a legitimate Democratic vote. These people that talk about democracy. Speaking of Congress, play the, I forget the number, it's later in my notes. Jamie Raskin, this is number 2.
I am working with a number of my colleagues, including Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Eric Swalwell, to revive legislation that we had to set up a process by which we could determine that someone who committed insurrection is disqualified by Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And the House of Representatives already impeached Donald Trump for participating in insurrection by inciting it. So the House has already pronounced upon that.
Right. And then he wasn't convicted in the Senate. These radicals in the House, they hurried to impeach him following the fake insurrection. We've already decided he's an insurrectionist. So we may just have to create legislation here in the House and get him out, get him off the ballot some way, somehow. And then others like Lawrence Tribe are complaining about the supermajority that would take to remove him from the ballot. I mean, the reason they set the high bar the way that they did, the framers, is so that these a band of radicals can't just take out a political opponent. That's what it amounts to. In any event, listen to Lawrence Tribe as he's the brainchild in many ways behind this attack brought on in Colorado. So he's going to stay with this. He's going to go to the grave with this. He's got to. He's right. He's like God. So many of these analysts are. They think they're God. There's no moment for reflection. There's no even consideration of repentance or change. They talk about putting it before the American people as if it's a bad thing. They don't want to see that happen. They want to destroy him with just one radical judge. That's all it takes. Here's Larry Tribe, clip 6.
In this case, the court appears to the naked eye to be deciding something 9-0. But when you peel back the appearances, it's really a 5-4 decision. The decisive fifth vote in this 5-4 split, I hasten to add, was the same as the decisive fifth vote in Bush versus Gore. It was Clarence Thomas, who some people believe had no business taking part in the case, to hold office. But the 5-justice majority in this case said, oh no, we're going to rewrite that for various reasons. We're going to rewrite it to say that unless you have legislation that requires, as you point out, not just a majority of the Senate, but given the filibuster rule, requires a supermajority of the Senate plus a majority of the House. Unless you have that legislation, you can't enforce this provision, so that an oath-breaking insurrectionist can hold office as long as minorities of the Congress are on that insurrectionist side. Decision of the Colorado Supreme Court, a carefully reasoned, elaborate explanation of why what happened in this case was an insurrection and why Donald Trump engaged in it, based on a trial whose fairness not a single one of the 9 justices questioned. It is the Supreme Court of the United States. All it had to do was affirm the decision of the Colorado court, saying there's ample evidence here in a trial that was fully fair, that applied constitutionally appropriate standards, ample evidence to disqualify this oath-breaking insurrectionist.
Oath-breaking insurrectionist. He wonders why it should be right for a supermajority to determine this in the Senate. He'd like it. They'd love it to be just a slim, simple majority. Just get the 51 on board. Just get the 220-ish in the House. And then keep them off the ballot. That's Lawrence Tribe, as I say. He's one of the architects of all this lawfare. This lawfare that's breaking down in front of their eyes. E. Jean Carroll, Letitia James, those cases are over, although being appealed. And they didn't hurt Donald Trump's cause. They helped him. People see the outrageous fees, $500 million, when it's all said and done, $500 million. But then these other cases, they're running into trouble. Jack Smith, the January 6th so-called insurrection case. The Supreme Court's holding that one up as well. We covered this yesterday. The announcement last week that they were going to rule on the immunity claim coming from Donald Trump. And so that trial takes place in April when the opinion is released. Who knows? June maybe at the earliest, July. It's derailing Jack Smith's case. The Boxes case, I think that one's in Florida. That's not really going anywhere. The Georgia RICO case, you know all about Fannie and Nathan, their little love affair. Those cases are hitting snags right and left. The only one that hasn't is perhaps the most ridiculous case. That's Alvin Bragg's case in Manhattan. But, you know, in Manhattan, just like in D.C., you're gonna be finding it easy to get a hate Trump jury. That's for sure. They're actually going after Trump in Manhattan on the campaign finance laws going back to 2016. I guess there's no statute of limitations. They're saying that basically he interfered in the election of 2016 for some kind of campaign finance. It doesn't even make sense. They haven't even really explained their case well. The Bulwark says here, it's all too easy to lose hope these days if you're looking to the courts to help save us from the threat of Donald Trump. Last week, the Supreme, well, it talks about some of the things that happened, have happened just over the last week. It says, but there's every reason to resist despair's siren song and not fall for the line you sometimes hear that Trump gets away with everything. Right. It's Trump who's getting away with crimes. These people are getting away with crimes. Further on, it says here, third and most importantly, Trump's day of reckoning before a jury in Alvin Bragg's 2016 election interference case begins on March 25. It's strong, important, and Trump can't stop it. So now we'll see what happens. Let's see how this one backfires. He can't stop it because far from being invulnerable, he's exposed his Achilles heel, as is typical of those who overcompensate for their own sense of weakness. Trump has constantly been trying to project strength, counterattacking on every front. In Bragg's case, Trump's ill-considered counterattack led him into an ambush of his own making. Uh-oh, Trump's finished. He walked right into a trap. It says here, perhaps you've noticed that Trump has not claimed immunity in the New York case as he did in the federal indictments in Washington, D.C. and Florida. I'm not even sure how he could have done that regarding something from back in 2016. In any event, it says the importance of Bragg's case is not to be minimized. It's all about Trump's election interference in 2016. See, you can't talk about election interference in 2020. That might get you thrown in jail awaiting a trial for 2.5 years. But these people not only talk about election interference, I mean, they're trying to put Donald Trump in jail for it. It says here, he kept the American people from having full information about him. He concealed information, the hush money to Stormy Daniels. If he would have revealed that during the election, there's no way Americans would have voted for him. Look at how much these people, not just Joe Biden or Barack Obama. I mean, you've got Barack Obama's DOJ, you've got the FBI working in cahoots with Twitter and social media to conceal the truth about the Biden crime family. Happened all through the lead up to 2020, that presidential election. I read this in the article today. Trump kept the American people from having full information about him? Really? Just as he's been trying to do in the 2024 campaign to prevent his criminal cases from reaching a jury verdict. But he's failed mightily in the Bragg case. Well, we'll see about that. We'll see. You know you're never going to get a fair judgment coming out of New York or D.C. I mean, look at the D.C. primary, as I mentioned yesterday. There were only 2,000 Republicans that even turned out for it. And it was Nikki Haley's first win. She won the swamp. Trump didn't even want it. Trump didn't even go there. Why would he? Listen to this from Whoopi Goldberg. You talk about unhinged. This is right on the level of Keith Olbermann, that tweet I read yesterday, clip 3.
Well, the Supreme Court won't hear oral arguments until the end of April. Now, I just, you know, just let's look at a scenario where The Supreme Court says, yes, he has that. He has all those rights. He is immune from everything.
Yeah.
You know what Joe Biden could do since he is presently president?
What?
Whoa. He could throw every Republican in jail.
Yeah.
I mean, he could.
Listen to the crowd reaction there. I mean, I think even they were stunned. This is the audience of at The View. He could throw every Republican in jail, but Trump is the authoritarian. Trump is the threat to democracy. These people are losing their minds. They're desperate. And that's a lot of times when they're the most dangerous, when they're lashing out in desperation. The clock is running out. What are we now? 8 months away? 9 months away? Donald Trump, just like we bring out in America Under Attack, I mean, he's exposed these people for who and what they are. He had an interview on Fox News. Listen to what he said. I think this was yesterday morning, but this is clip 8.
What do you think about this left-wing movement?
Well, it's the same losers. They're real losers. If they spent their time focusing on the country and making America great again, that would be a lot better than just wasting their time. I've been going through it for years, beating them for years, and it's the same voices, the same faces. They never stop. They don't care about our country. I don't think they love our country, frankly. They love themselves or their movement, and it's a sick movement. And I'm just focused on winning an election.
They love themselves. He's right about that. It's a sick, sick, and deranged movement. It's an attack. It's an attack on America. Rich Lowry had a piece, I don't know if I'll have time to get to it, but he said that, look, this what's happening at the southern border, the invasion, this is on purpose. And he goes through and he points out the first actions that Joe Biden took as the fake president. He opened the border. People are now seeing, most of them stop short at saying the dear leader's behind it all. But they're even beginning to use the dear leader's language. This is fundamental transformation. This is an actual attack. This is happening on purpose. Look at what the steal back in 2020. Look at what it has revealed. Here's Donald Trump. He's running for the presidency, has been for over a year, but he's just living on his own as a private citizen down in Florida. But look at what has been exposed. These persecutors, guilty of what they blame Trump for. This article at the Federalist. You're speaking of exposing this evil. Donald Trump's also exposed the rhinos. He's exposed the Uniparty. He's exposed how weak most Republicans are. How that they've just stood by on the sidelines as they've watched this fundamental transformation take place since 2009. It's been going on for 15 years. This is not the same country it was 15 years ago. Mitch McConnell's retirement marks the end of the disastrous Bush era. This is at the Federalist, and you know, McConnell is stepping down after the November election as the Senate leader. And, you know, it's saying that McConnell and his people are trying to connect him because he's been around for so long. They're trying to connect him to, you know, Reagan era conservatism. It says here, though, any serious attempt to understand history's longest serving Senate leader needs to focus on the age in which he rose to power. Those 8 years of Republican rule in the early 2000s. A 42-year-old McConnell may have won his first Senate race at the height of the Reagan years, but by the time he won the mantle of minority leader, those days were gone. More than anything, Mitch McConnell was a Bush Republican. A good old Bush Republican, just like Liz Cheney. A Bush Republican. How's that working out for them now? This has become Donald Trump's party. I played that clip for you yesterday where Trump said at the campaign rally over the weekend, you know, some say that it's divided. It's like 50% Trump, 50%, you know, traditional Republican. He said it's not. It's 95-96% Trump. And we're getting rid of the Mitch McConnell Republicans. This article says here he's not alone in either sense. A good number of the Bush-era alumni like to shroud their doomsaying about the new right in Reagan's cowl. This makes sense. How hollow would it ring to hear the honest truth that these Republican elites clashing so violently with the new right represent the Bush wing of the GOP, so publicly rejected by their own voters. Few Americans of either party hold much nostalgia about the George W. Bush presidency. And former Rep. Liz Cheney's headlong charge into obscurity doesn't quite inspire imitators. Better to draw your authority from a deeper well. When we read this morning, it made us think of this clip. Tony Busby, you'll remember this if you were watching the program last year. This was from his closing argument in the Ken Paxton impeachment. Paxton beat a Bushy, and they tried to destroy him through lawfare. That's right, Republicans trying to destroy a conservative attorney general, one that they didn't like, one that wasn't close enough to Liz Cheney or Mitch McConnell. Listen to Busby from last year, clip 11.
Ken Paxton won hands down, resounding victory. He beat the latest in line for the Bushes. Let it be known, let it be clear now. The Bush era in Texas ends today. We thought it had ended in the primary when Ken Paxton beat George P. Bush 68-32. Well, we thought it was over. It wasn't. Well, now we have an impeachment. It ends today.
68-32. And they were bitter. Karl Rove and company. They hate Ken Paxton. They tried to destroy Ken Paxton. Again, using all of these tactics that the radical Democrats use to try to take out Trump. The end of the Bush era. I could listen to that clip several times. This is from The Federalist. It says, within the Senate, McConnell often operated as a sort of third party. His knowledge of the institution and ability to deliver GOP votes on Democratic priorities gained him far greater power over outcomes than his minority status provided. To deliver GOP votes on Democratic priorities? What? Yeah, I mean, except for the Supreme Court appointees, he's just a Democrat. That's what he is. It says, while he could routinely wrangle a few Republicans to join Democratic majorities, his record of successfully cajoling Democrats into joining Republican majorities is virtually non-existent. It was never about bringing Democrats over to the Republican side. It was always to try to help the Democrats with a few good old boys to join their ranks. Oh, yes. Bipartisan. That's right. We've got to do this together. We've got to show that we're unified. It says here, while McConnell's is a complicated legacy and not one to simply write off, Ronald Reagan's brand of traditional conservatism, it was not. More than any youthful Ronald Reagan fandom, McConnell's perspective on leadership was fully shaped by a life as an appropriator. His legacy epitomizes the Republican Party of the 2000s, the Bush era, that is. Corporate tax cuts, unfettered spending on defense and liberal programs, and the abandonment of any serious legislative efforts on cultural issues from abortion to marriage to immigration. These problems that are killing America, they've just been going on for decades and decades, and a lot of it under McConnell's watch. I mean, if he was Senate leader for his party in the early 2000s, I mean, he's been in that position for what, a couple decades? What kind of legislation have they been responsible for? To close the border, for example, to protect America's sovereignty. This is that article I mentioned from Rich Lowry. says here, President Biden was the headline, Joe Biden knowingly and purposely blew up the border in 2021. Don't believe his blame game now. That's right. Just go back just a few years. Just go back 3 years and look at his actions. Judge by the fruits. But here again, a larger point that can be made here is that the trumpet has been saying for years this is an attack. That's the whole point of this book. America's under attack. We've been saying this for years. We've been saying it since the first little version of the booklet came out in 2013. Over 10 years. And now just about everybody is saying it. They just stopped short of the dear leader as far as the root cause of it, as far as the one leading the fundamental transformation. So Lowry brings the receipts. Listen to this. It says, President Biden was inaugurated on January 20th, 2021. Weeks later, February 2, that's just like 2 weeks later, February 2, he issued the executive order that began the unraveling at the border in earnest. The border crisis isn't something that happened to Biden. It's not a product of circumstances or understandable policy mistakes made under duress. No, he sought it and created it on principle and as a matter of urgency. It wasn't a second year priority or even a second quarter of the first year priority. The new president set out in his initial days and weeks in office to destroy what President Donald Trump had built, most consequentially in the February 2nd executive order. Well, how about that? It says, by then, mind you, there had already been significant action to loosen up on the border, including on his first day in office. Says the February 2 order emphasized an effort to enhance lawful pathways for migration to this country and revoked a slew of Trump rules, executive orders, proclamations, and memoranda. Says here, the sense of it was that there's nothing we can or should do on our own to control illegal immigration. Rather, we had to fix deep-seated social, economic, and political problems in Central America instead. Yeah, some of you might be old enough to remember Kamala Harris and others talking about, you know, we've got to go to Central America and fix problems there. We can't secure our border. We can't enhance our border security. We've got to deal with climate change. This is why people are flooding into the country. It's too hot, I guess. It's too hot in their home country. It says here, the executive order, though, is a stark reminder that the current chaos is the product of deliberate policy. It's the product of deliberate policy. It's an attack. It's an invasion. And Barack Obama is the one leading the charge. Listen to Donald Trump again from his telephone interview on Fox News, clip 10.
Our country is a mess, and right. I think you have a much different country than you do. We're going to make a heavy play for New York. We're going to make a heavy play for Virginia, states that generally don't go Republican. I think they're going to go Republican in a lot. I think the Democrats have themselves a big problem.
Well, it's fascinating what's taking place. I think a lot of people are dumbfounded by your numbers, and especially over this past weekend, and you compound the momentum you got with the Supreme Court decision.
Well, even Kilmeade's coming around, I see. The Fox News anchor, the morning guy. No big fan of Trump, but Trump keeps crushing it. So what is Fox left to do? He says there that the country's in a mess, and he feels like New York and Virginia's in play. You probably could throw in New Jersey. The Democrats, this is why they're in full-scale meltdown mode. Because they know they're running out of options. They know that their policies on the border, for example, are not popular. Far from it. They know Donald Trump's increasing in his popularity. It's pretty amazing to watch, as I've been saying. The war in 24, what a year. And in the news stack this morning, I mean, you had all these other hot button issues or items happening all over the world as we've pointed out recently. I mean, there's not just the U.S. presidential election. There's quite a few other elections worldwide as well. It's shaping up to be an earth-shaking year in every respect. When we come back, we'll conclude today's show with our Bible study segment. You are listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We'll be right back.
What has happened to the United States of America? The wealthiest, most powerful nation in human history is suddenly divided, weakened, radical. The evil in America has grown powerful. The good has grown weak. The honorable parts of American history are succumbing to a direct, targeted, sustained assault. Someone, something is dismantling America's history, purpose, and character.
Fundamentally transforming the United States of America.
Political dysfunction, social strife, economic peril, catastrophic moral failure, fires, attacks, riots, lies. The nation is being attacked from within by its own leaders. Powerful elites in government, journalism, academia, and beyond are intentionally, rapidly destroying what America is in order to make it into something else. There is a reason why your nation is crumbling before your eyes. There is a spirit and a specific perpetrator that is attempting to blot out America. Only America Under Attack reveals that perpetrator and the motive and spirit behind him. This newly expanded book shows you the reason why America has changed so dramatically, so suddenly. If you're confused and concerned about what is happening to America, request your free copy of America Under Attack by Gerald Fleury at thetrumpet.com.
We also noticed this morning in the news stack the announcement that Victoria Nuland is going to retire. She's the third highest ranking U.S. diplomat in the State Department, I believe. And she comes out from the Obama era. And we're beginning to see some of these Obama acolytes that embedded themselves into the fake presidency of Joe Biden. Are they abandoning ship? It's pretty interesting. Victoria Nuland, the U.S. diplomat and frequent target of criticism for her hawkish views on Russia and its actions in Ukraine, will leave her post this month. Nuland, a career Foreign Service officer who served as an assistant secretary, well, it gives some of her bio, but it'll be interesting to see if others abandon ship here as they see the Titanic about to crash. They're not going to go down without a fight. I'm not saying that. But they're not going to compromise with the other side either. If they lose, even if they lose in spectacular fashion, you can only imagine what kinds of actual insurrections are going to be happening all over the country. All you have to do is go back to 2016 and 17. To see how that they welcomed Donald Trump into his first term, screaming on the streets of Washington, D.C. We all saw what they did in the Summer of Love, 2020. They're capable of executing acts of violence all over the place. They've proven it. They've shown it. And hardly any of them have been held to account. Hardly any of them went to jail. There were murders, dozens of them, murders, actual murders, quite unlike the January 6th protest. Nobody gunned down, except for Ashley Babbitt. Yesterday, I talked about the sure word of prophecy and just how much of a comfort it is knowing that all of these events leading into the Great Tribulation, it all culminates in the return of Jesus Christ to this earth and the establishment of God's kingdom on earth. I mean, you look around and you see the desperate need for new government, perfect government. That Government Is Coming, The Wonderful World Tomorrow book, describes it in such beautiful detail. That was written by Herbert Armstrong many decades ago. If you don't have a copy, you can go to our website, thetrumpet.com, or call our operators. The 800 number is 1-866-930-3024. Notice 1 Corinthians 13, just to follow on that verse from yesterday, 2 Peter 1 and verse 19, you know, that day star rising in our hearts, keeping that hopeful vision alive in our mind's eye. Thayer's Lexicon says about 2 Peter 1 and verse 19, if I might just finish this point first. It says, I will give to him the morning star that he may be irradiated with its splendor and outshine all the others like the morning star. God says a true Christian, a follower of Christ, will be irradiated with splendor. He'll be a bright and shining star, filled with joy. How could Christ, the night before his crucifixion, be educating his disciples on the subject of joy? I mean, that was a heavy time. And he was praying for hours and hours. You can read about that in Luke 22. But he told the disciples, look, if you're following me and my example, you're going to be filled with joy. And no one's going to be able to take that away from you. 1 Corinthians 13 here is the God-inspired definition of love. It says here, love is very patient. This is from the Moffat translation. Love is very patient. It's very kind. Love knows no jealousy. Love makes no parade. Love gives itself no airs. It's never rude, never selfish, never irritated, never resentful. Love is never glad when others go wrong. Love is gladdened by goodness. You think about that soundbite in the first segment, Donald Trump saying, I don't even think they love their country. They just love themselves, these people, these lunatics. They love themselves, these communist radical leftists. They love fundamental transformation. They love wide open borders. They love destroying the country. They love burning things down. Where is God's love? You don't see it in this world, except in a very few people. Love is gladdened by goodness, always slow to expose, always eager to believe the best, always hopeful, always patient. Love never disappears. Imagine a world just covered in that kind of unselfish, outflowing concern for others. Imagine if everyone was living that way. Well, that time is coming. It's not that far away from us either. And the missing dimension in sex, Mr. Armstrong's book, he defined love this way. This is, of course, God's love. That's what Paul was defining in 1 Corinthians 13. Agape love, that's the Greek word. Here, Mr. Armstrong says, love is an unselfish, outflowing concern for the good and welfare of the one loved. It says love is primarily on the giving, serving, sharing side of the fence, not on the getting, taking, factional, striving side. It is not selfish. It's not selfish. Agape love is the kind of love that God has, even for this world. John 3:16 says, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. He gave his Son as that perfect lamb sacrifice. And Jesus himself sacrificed for the good of mankind. It wasn't enough for God and the Son to just talk about the plan and the purpose, to tell us about godly love. They've shown us, they've demonstrated how that love works in action. They've loved this world, even as the world just shakes its fist defiantly at God, is hostile toward the law of God. Mr. Armstrong said this, just to continue the definition. It says, love is unselfish. It is not an emotion, though it may be expressed with an emotional content. It says, true love combines the rational aspect of outgoing concern, desire to help, serve, give or share, along with sincere, concerned, affectionate feelings. So he says, you know, love is not an emotion. It's not like what is portrayed in Hollywood in a romantic movie where people just get into the very first infatuation that they see and they're off and running on this torrid romance. And then Hollywood never shows you what generally happens to relationships that start like that. They don't last. There's not a solid foundation there to build on. As I tell my marriage and family students, good marriages and families are, they have to be built. And that takes a lot of work and construction, so to speak. Spiritually speaking, you've got to build a happy marriage. There's certain things that you must do. Following admonition in Ephesians 5 or Revelation 2, Revelation 19, all kinds of passages. Colossians 3. But just coming back to this definition and the fact that God's love, again, which is action-oriented, it's unselfish, outflowing concern for the good and welfare of others. You're concerned about the other guy. Read through Philippians 2 sometime. And it tells you, don't just be concerned about your own things. Think about the affairs and the things of others. And then it points us to the example of Jesus Christ. It says, let this mind be in you. And then it talks about the sacrifice that Jesus Christ made. I mean, he was God from the beginning, and there was no beginning. He had been an eternally living, all-powerful being in the Godhead. And he gave all of that up to come in the form of human flesh. And that's not all. Then, while in the flesh, he sacrificed everything. He was brutally beaten and crucified so that we might be reconciled to the Father in heaven. And now, of course, Christ lives. He was resurrected from the dead 3 days, 3 nights later, 3 full days and 3 full nights later. God raised him to life, and he is now at the right hand of God, serving as our high priest and advocate when we sin, as 1 John 2:1 says. And soon he will return to this earth, just as he promised in the parable of the pounds. Just as he said over in John 14, if I go, I'm coming again. I'm coming back. And all the disciples in the first century, they kept asking him, when are you coming back? When is it going to happen? This was fresh on their minds day in and day out. They were believers in the return of Jesus Christ. Most people in traditional Christianity today, no, not so much believers in the return of Christ or the Olivet prophecy and all that, the great tribulation that is prophesied to happen right before he returns. Most people just dismiss that, or maybe they spiritualize it away. God says that's like the day star in our hearts. This is what we're setting our hearts on. Seek first the kingdom and his righteousness, and God will add all of these things to you. But just coming back to this definition of God's love, it's action-oriented. But Mr. Armstrong says it should combine with emotional content. Now, God doesn't want us to be emotionally out of control, like so much of what you see in this world. People that just get violently angry or depressed. They can't function. Just wild swings of behavior based on almost solely emotion. And yet, God, because he is perfect and because he is love, as it says in 1 John 4, he keeps his emotions perfectly in control. He's an emotional being. You can look through the scriptures and see God and Jesus Christ. They rejoice. In the case of Christ in John 7, he's shouting, he's crying out. He wasn't just some dry, pedantic scholar. you know, speaking in hushed tones because, well, that's what scholars do. Jesus cried out. He laughed. God laughs. It says that in Psalms 2. They scream at times. They can be angry or indignant. They obviously mourn and express sorrow. There's certain verses in the New Testament talking about Jesus weeping. I forget who it was that it says that he wept until he could weep no more. It might have been King David, one of the prophets of old, perhaps. But look at the example that God and Jesus Christ set for us. Two very emotional beings, and yet that emotion is very much kept in check by an obedient, lawful existence. Obedience to these laws, to the law that is love. Their love for others is just perfectly combined and expressed with a lot of emotional content. They love humanity, and yet that love is about to be demonstrated with strong correction, correction in love, just like what's described in Hebrews 12. Every parent should be well aware of this. That's part of our responsibility. Love and affection and encouragement, those are all necessary too, but so is correction. So is correction. Mr. Armstrong, he said this in a sermon back in 1978. He said, lately it has become stylish to say that Mr. Armstrong is very much out of date. There's a word, prophesy, in the Bible that does mean receive prophecies from God like ancient prophets and foretell, but also, in more cases, it means to preach. Prophesy, to preach. And it means to preach with inspiration, a fired up kind of preaching. Today, it seems like we've got to have a very mild, modern, intellectual classroom lecture. And it's gotten to be out of style on the platform and in the church, on this platform and in this church, for someone to really speak out. He said, I was glad to hear a little speaking out in the sermonette this morning. I want to hear more of it. I want to hear more of that absolute conviction. He says, now the Holy Spirit of God in us is not emotion, but there certainly is an emotional content, and it certainly does work on our emotions. Now, some people, they just have emotions on their shirt sleeves, and I don't mean that at all. So there's a balance there. We want to be emotionally mature, not immature. Immature little brats that lose our tempers. But we don't want to go to the other extreme and just kind of suppress all expression of godly emotion. We want to find that balance, and God, through the power of His Holy Spirit, will help us to arrive at that balanced position. He'll guide us, He'll direct us. If we're set, if our hearts are convicted of this way of life, I mean, we're going to be jumping up and down from time to time. We're going to be rejoicing in prayer. We're going to shed tears of sorrow, tears of joy, perhaps, because God is in us, because this is the way God lives. This is the way God the Father and Christ the Son live out their lives. God doesn't want us to be some, you know, robot that just has all these automatic actions and never does show or express emotion. He expects those who live the way of give, who live the way of love, to combine that godly love with a lot of emotional content, for sure. That's all we have time for on today's show. You're listening to Stephen Flurry, and this is the Trumpet Daily. We appreciate you joining us for the program today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.